This is Cable Reports for February 2006. Cable Reports is an oral digest of what's the haps both on and off the air at your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM. This show was produced by Robinette Jones, Cherie Blackfeather, Eduardo de Lenderos Thierry, Ivan Rivero, and Gloria Luz Sanchez Alvarado. We dedicate this show to our foremothers in Africa.
Secrets in Mexico. Among the whispers has been the fact that the African has been part of our lives since the Spanish ships dropped anchor off the Mexican coasts. So, a small group of us, made up of me, Eduardo de Landeros Tierra, and Ivan Rivero, had lunch and a few drinks with Mexico's most renowned researchers of the African in Mexico, Dr. Maria Elisa Velasquez and filmmaker Rafael Robayar. They recently were welcome guests and presenters at the 16th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films at the Cascade campus of Portland Community College. The festival is still underway until March 4th.
Remarks of Dr. Velasquez and a panel of experts, which included Dr. Luz Maria Gordillo, a professor of history at Washington State University, and Dr. Cecilien Axilien, a professor of French language and culture at Columbia College in Columbia, Georgia, were followed by a community discussion about the intersections of the Latino and African cultures in Portland and primarily at the Northeast Portland of today. In Mexico, it is almost unknown the fact that there was an influx of 250,000 Africans who arrived through its eastern ports in Veracruz and Campeche in the course of three centuries. In a story that resembles the forced immigration into America, both men and women from the western coast of Africa were brought into the Mexican coast with historical consequences. The inroads they made into the current Mexican population and its vibrant culture can be seen even today, despite the unwillingness of the larger Mexican population to acknowledge what Mexican film director Rebollar Corona calls the third route. But not all Mexicans arrived as a result of the slave trade. At the time of the conquest, there were free men coming from various parts of Spain who joined as soldiers and who eventually became encomenderos, landowners, very rich, and in turn, slave owners. The records show at least two prominent black men, Juan Cortes and Juan Garrido, who came to America as soldiers and later became encomenderos. Their dark skin impressed the native population as something of high spiritual regard. As the colony developed and after massive deaths of the native populations happened due to disease, war, displacement, and forced labor, the indigenous population was decimated. Catholic Church authorities declared that the Indians were possessors of a soul, therefore subjects of the crown. ensuing a better legal status and treatment. Many of the jobs that could no longer be performed by the Indians, mining, sugar crops, and the harshest of jobs, had to be done now by peoples who were being brought from the far coasts of Africa. However, the ensuing development of these peoples in America followed a different model than the American models in the U.S. late in the 18th century. First, because in Mexico, this migration happened at earlier times, which permitted a miscegenation to occur. Such miscegenation, or in Spanish, mestizaje, occurred for 300 years before the issue of color became equivalent to the value in social mobility prevalent during the years preceding the movement of Mexican independence in 1810. By the end of the 18th century, proponents of encyclopedia felt a need to classify everything: plants, mountains, lands, and people, giving rise to the categorization of the populations in the New Spain into 54 different pools of blood, according to the different amounts of a certain ancestry in a particular person. These catalogs of people show the amalgamation of the three main groups: Spaniard, Indian, and African. This categorization gave rise to ridiculous pejoratives like salta para atrás, jumping backward, which meant that a person was becoming darker. These classifications were documented as cuadros, or pictorial representations of the racial, ethnic, and ethnological assumptions of who these people were. However, according to Mexican researcher, historian Dr. Maria Elisa Velasquez, these inhumane classifications were never officially used to encase a person in any document or parochial book of entries. Instead, other historians and researchers have found out that sugar mills, one of the top industries of the New Spain, kept detailed records of their slaves, their place of origin in Africa, their jobs, and that the slaves were highly esteemed. The slaves, which held positions of influence, were valued as much as the price of a mansion in those times, and therefore well cared for. In search of freedom, most Africans intermarried with the local indigenous population, knowing their children would be born free. By the end of the 18th century, slaves ran free through the streets. Slavery was no longer an economical proposition. What about gender demographics? Dr. Velasquez said that in the beginning, most of the men arriving from Spain did not bring their women, permitting intermarriage. At the turn of the 17th century, there were more women in Mexico, especially black women, in the cities, performing different activities, being nursemaids, housemaids, and many other occupations. As way of example of the dynamic cultural and linguistic exchange, the film cites the case of a woman who, having arrived from Africa, spoke Nahuatl, the native tongue of the Aztecs, and prayed to the native indigenous gods to obtain favors for her followers seeking love, healing, and peace. We get to hear about this woman in the records of the Mexican Inquisition of the 17th century. What happened then to the indigenous population is that it had a great loss, but it never disappeared. During the colonial period, many things were tried. Colonial authorities tried to gather them within districts according to their nation, but this didn't work. They wanted to keep the Indians away from the bad customs of the Africans. They tried to keep them separate, but they couldn't. The numbers are different in Mexico as they are from the United States. In three centuries, 250,000 Africans arrived in Mexico, while 500,000 arrived in the U.S. There's also a difference in time. The Africans arrived in Mexico in the 1500s, while most of the Africans that arrived in the U.S. arrived much later. To answer the question of why the African ancestry has been forgotten in Mexico, Dr. Velasquez said it's been forgotten for several reasons. First, because there was an African presence very early. When the ideas of prejudice arrived in Mexico, and they were negative, we tried to deny them. Then there was a very important movement to unify the nation. But it's not the African who has been forgotten in Mexico. It's indigenous. The indigenous people were erased as well. The indigenous that is honored in Mexico is the one who's dead, the one present at the Museum of Archaeology. But contemporary Indians, those who suffer marginalization, hunger, and destitution, we don't want to hear about them. Jacobo Paez a local academic on the subject of the black image in Latin American literature, said, "It's important to talk about the forgotten root. This present is vibrant at home, today, not only in Mexico, as well in various countries." Mr. Paez, who's a native of Guatemala, comments, "I grew up at El Rastro in Puerto Barrios, where 90% of all inhabitants are visibly of African ancestry. Yet no one admits to this ancestry. The inhabitants of Livingston, a coastal town in the Atlantic side of Guatemala," he says, "are visibly of African ancestry. The African in Guatemala is the one in Livingston." He mentioned that Professor Marco Polo Hernandez Cuevas, who's a pioneer in the U.S. in the study of the black ancestry in Mexico, has been a great influence on the admission of this forgotten root. As Dr. Hernandez Cuevas has told me, Jacobo Paez says, "African blood runs deeply in America, whether visible or not."
This look at the African influence in Mexico, a co-production of Ivan Rivero with Eduardo de Landeros Tierra.
KBOO celebrates International Women's Day on March 8th with 24 hours of programming by and about women, starting at 3 a.m. with reggae, then folk music with Flower. Stay tuned all morning for news and public affairs. A roundtable discussion at noon hosted by Ivan Rivero of Multi-Ethnic and Intergenerational Women. The women from the AP Collective present their interview with Margaret Cho. Murilo will host a global feminisms roundtable. There will also be music throughout the day, including world music, blues, and punk rock, a special music and commentary about Zap Mama. The full schedule of International Women's Day programming can be found in the March KBOO program guide or on our website at www.kboo.fm.
All eyes on baby, darling daughter. She's learning to speak the words we taught. All eyes on
the goal of this project is to continue expanding what we mean when we say the word woman, and to recognize our similarities, our differences, and what makes our particular experiences unique.
My name is Hava. I am 31. I'm from Littleton, Colorado, and I am a teacher and a researcher. To be a woman is a lot of different things. I think these are all things I've realized in my adult life, but for a long time I didn't want to be a woman. I didn't want to identify as a woman. And I think I've always associated it with powerlessness and weakness.
Silence is golden. Brush your hair back, tie it tight and trim, knees pressed together, darling, raise that chin.
So, being a woman means to discover strength after going through a period of not knowing you have strength. And it's also to be socialized to be quiet and pleasing and accommodating, and to experience the joy and power of straying from those prescriptions. So I think there's a certain joy and a danger and awareness in using one's voice as a woman.
I don't think that there was any role models that I had when I was growing up, anybody that I could look to and say, wow, I want to be like that. You know, I never saw anybody. You know, the only thing that's sort of Asian that was like that was Hello Kitty. I don't want to model myself after Hello Kitty. She has no mouth. She cannot even say hi back to you after you say, Hello Kitty.
In the years since Margaret Cho first started doing stand-up comedy at age 16, she herself has become a role model for many, and she has done so on her own terms. In an industry with very narrow options and roles for Asian American women, she has managed to defy stereotypes and carve a space with her defiant, raw, and incisive humor. Much of her comedy draws on her personal experiences, detailing her life as a self-proclaimed proud fag hag, her sexuality, her relationship to her mother, and her struggle with racism, substance abuse, and eating disorders. In doing so, her work has given voice and validity to experiences that do not conform to straight white norms.
To have formal instruction in social and emotional education. They need to be able to play about it and have games about it in order to develop friendship skills and be able to cooperate and work as a group. And they need, you know, help developing values that are going to protect them from social and relational aggression.
You know, what strikes me in this conversation is that the way we're raising boys and girls, it's like neither are able to be fully human.
Social and emotional skills and conflict skills would really change the playing field for all children, for boys and girls.
This emotional education you're talking about, I just think is vital for the future of our species and the planet and every other nation.
International Women's Day, observed on March 8, is a celebration of economic, social, and political achievement of women around the globe. The first International Women's Day was on February 28, 1909, but its roots reach back to March 8, 1857, when female garment workers in New York City staged a protest over working conditions in the factories. International Women's Day was observed throughout the 1910s and 1920s, but diminished in popularity until it was revitalized by the feminist movement of the 1960s. International Women's Day was officially sanctioned by the United Nations in 1975.
It's a good day to run. Freedom is a scary thing, so precious, so easy to lose.
Over 200 million years ago, the Earth's surface didn't resemble those multicolored maps you find in grade schools today. There were no borders, no fences, no great walls, no black lines carved into our consciousness designating this piece of Earth to this group and that piece to that group. 200 million years ago, the Earth, its diverse people and animals coexisted on one gigantic supercontinent. We call that place Pangaea.
As one, then we drifted, separated as continents that shifted. All the pieces fit, can't you see the togetherness, visionary Pangaea? We started as one, then we drifted, separated as continents that shifted. All the pieces fit, can't you see the togetherness, visionary Pangaea?
Pangaea in Greek means all the land, and according to the continental drift theory, This supercontinent covered about half of the Earth until it began to separate because parts of the Earth's crust is adrift atop a liquid core. If the land beneath us is in constant flux, pulling and breaking away from itself, what then can we do to put those pieces back together? How can we get back to a world reunited? That's the vision guiding the Pangea Project, an exciting new nonprofit organization that connects Portland's low-income youth to social and environmental justice projects in other parts of the world. Executive Director Deb Delman.
The primary focus of what Pangea is really all about is this idea that you don't have to be rich or famous to change the world, and that there are grassroots change makers and community leaders all over the world, including here in Portland, that have really made a difference in not only in their communities, but in the broader world. So the Pangea Project is a year-long program for low-income teenagers from Portland, where we get them involved in local and international community service projects. So the idea is to offer an opportunity like this to students who would typically not have a chance to do something internationally. We work with a group of 12 students for the year, learning about a theme. So we choose a social or an environmental issues such as homelessness or hunger or environmental justice, and we spend the year learning about how that issue plays out locally and in the country that we're going to travel to. We travel to Ecuador this summer. It's our first trip. We're taking the students to learn about environmental justice issues in Ecuador. And how we're doing this is we'll be in Ecuador for 4 to 5 weeks. And initially, we're partnering with Global Exchange. And we're participating in a two-week reality tour. The reality tour is designed to show the students firsthand an issue from all different angles. So we'll travel around the country from the northern highlands into the Amazon rainforest to learn about communities that are dealing with issues of environmental justice, from threats of multinational mining companies to oil drilling in the Amazon. Pero para María no hay madrugada. Pero para María no hay mediodía. Pero para María ninguna luna. Su copa roja sobre las aguas. María no tiene tiempo de alzar los ojos. After the two-week reality tour, they will then be engaged in a community service project by living with host families and working on an environmental restoration project. The design of our international program is to first show them the problem, show them people working on the solutions, and then give them an opportunity to be part of the solution themselves.
The mission of the Pangea Project is to promote the development of leadership skills, increase global awareness, and foster a commitment to work towards social change. The founders stress that their goals and objectives should not be construed as charity, and that their students should not be viewed as privileged pilgrims traveling to some other place just to realize how lucky they are in Portland.
Our program, we're not taking our students on a cruise. We're taking them to learn about very pressing and very current social and environmental issues. And so the content of what they're teaching about is really significant information. They're stories that need to be told. They're really coming back as ambassadors to the people that we visit and sharing their stories and their struggles. Each participant in our program is expected to raise 10% of the cost of the program. And the idea behind that is so that each student has a sense of accountability and ownership of their program. We certainly don't want cost to be an inhibiting factor, but we feel like they should have some buy-in into this experience. another aspect of our program, which is an exciting new development, is our students' participation in Peace Jam. Each year, throughout the year, there's a regional conference where one Nobel Peace Prize winner comes to the area and hundreds of students from all over the region meet with that person. It's very fortuitous for us that this year's Nobel Peace Prize winner that's coming to the Pacific Northwest is Rigoberta Menchu, an indigenous Guatemalan woman who is the first indigenous Nobel Peace Prize winner ever.
To continue the successful growth of its programs, the Pangea Project is currently looking for volunteers, sponsors, donations, and board members. For more information on how you can contribute or get involved, contact Executive Director Deb Delman at 503-233-8145 or Volunteer Coordinator Kimberly Wright at 503-544-5760. You can also visit their website, www.thepangeaprojects.org. I was happy with his choices, the maxing and mixing, the beats they were fixing. My brain like a smoke that was doubly, triply dope. The decadence is gone and life might never be the same as when the beat hits. You feel no pain, so a piece of peace for you, a piece of peace for me, a piece of peace for every peaceful person that you see. I played a piece of peace for you, a piece of peace for me, a piece of peace for every peaceful person that you see. I did a piece of peace for you, a piece of peace for me, a piece of peace for every peaceful person that you see. I did a piece of peace for you, and a piece of peace for me, but I don't act peaceful if you're not the way to me.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor An Evening in Vietnam, a benefit for Village School Foundation. Experience Vietnamese culture through music and dance featuring nationally known guitarist and storyteller Dun. Enjoy Vietnamese food and a special video presentation of the Village School Foundation's recent efforts to provide education resources to the children of Vietnam. The event will be held at 6:30 p.m. Saturday, February 25th at the PCC Rock Creek Campus, Building Number 3. For more information, please call 503-957-0740 or 503-997-2260.
KBOO has an immediate opening available for a 10-hour per week part-time office assistant. The position is available to Portland Community College students who have federal work-study award and skills in office administration. To apply for this position, please email your resume with a brief letter of interest to membership@kboo.org. If you would like more information about the position, email or call 503-231-8032, extension 207. The position will remain open until filled.
Greetings, this is Contessa de la Luna, once again inviting you to attend the KBOO Board of Directors meeting. That's right, once is not enough when you have such a good thing. I invite you to attend Saturday, February 25th, 10 a.m., 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. That's the KBOO Board of Directors meeting this Saturday, 10 a.m. Be part of your community radio station, KBOO. Be active. Be there.
Good morning. This is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm sitting in today for Pat McGuire. Pat McGuire hosts Boneheads and Bigots, normally heard on the fourth Friday of every month at 10:30. She's sick today and can't come in, and so we're going to have a different program, and I hope you can stay with us. We are going to be talking about a program that is part of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, which is formerly Voices from the Wilderness.